So throughout November and December, Bill gave us a whole series of lessons on apologetics. Hopefully you guys remember those. If you didn't get a chance to listen to them, I would totally go back and listen to them. The idea was just, how do I defend what I believe to those around us? Some topics he touched on were, just kind of being up to date with people that are out there. How do we reach those people where they are? Like Ken said, there's no slides, so I can't show you my slides, but that's the way it goes. I was going to turn it around. Everybody can read my notes, right? Okay. We could break out the whiteboard, I guess, but that would be maybe a chalkboard. So there was two lessons that really struck me from what he did. I forget, there was four or five. It was kind of I think it started out as three and it ended up somewhere beyond three that Bill did. But he gave seven reasons why you can believe the Bible. So there's archaeology. It's accurate. You can go look at the things that are still out there that exist. Let me get rid of this thing. There's revelation. The Bible is infallible. The origin of the Bible, it's unique relative to other books and documents that are out there. The fact that Jesus is in there, we can see his story. That there's prophecy throughout the whole Bible. That sets us apart from all other religions that are out there. The transmission of the Bible, that we actually have so many copies of it today. I forget the numbers, but when you compare it to the Iliad and the Odyssey and other books that people believe in, it's not even comparable. And then there's also just the impact that it's had in people's lives, the impact it's had on society. The second lesson that struck out to me was, there's a lot of overlap here, but it's like, why is the God of the Bible the one and true God that we can believe? So there's historical evidence, similar to archaeology. It's all verifiable. There's cities, there's things that have happened. There's prophetic evidence, again, it's 100% accurate. There's the philosophical evidence in the Bible that it answers the questions of life. Why am I here? What am I supposed to do? There's also the evidence of impact, the long-term greatness that we've seen through the church of Christians throughout the world. There's pragmatic evidence, the fact that it just works. Right? Like if I do what God wants me to do, I can see the blessings that come about. There's the evidence of uniqueness. So it's in contrast to all other religions. And then the last one is just the experiential evidence. So the lives that are changed throughout the gospel, we've seen, I've been studying with a high school class just on Paul. Right, so we saw how much his life was changed just by seeing Jesus. But he's not the only example. There's just example after example throughout Acts of conversions and people that changed their lives. There's Cornelius, there's the Ethiopian eunuch, there's Lydia. There's people after people throughout there. I'm sure the boys can tell me the ones I'm forgetting. But what I want to focus on this morning is the prophecies that we see throughout the Bible. And in particular, what I want to look at is messianic prophecy, the prophecies about Jesus. And even at that, I'm going to go one subset even deeper. I want to go through some examples of prophecy. How do I say this? So a lot of times when we read the Old Testament, we'll read a verse and we'll say, yeah, that must be messianic because that sounds like Jesus in that verse. It could be. It might not be either. But the ones I want to look at are the ones that it says it in the Old Testament, and then it says it in the New Testament saying that was about Jesus. Okay? And there's a number of them. It's not like just one or two. But a lot of times when I read Psalms, there's things that sound like they're messianic, and they could be, and they describe what happened to Jesus. And I'm not saying those aren't prophecies. I just want to look at ones this morning that we specifically can point to Jesus, both in the Old Testament and New Testament. And these are the type of prophecies that, they talk about his birth, they talk about where he lived, they talk about his life, they talk about the end of his life. So it's not just, you know, one little aspect of his life. It's throughout his whole life. So some of the prophecies that we're going to read from this morning are from Isaiah, Micah, Hosea, Zechariah. I think most of you have a general idea of when the prophets spoke, but we know they weren't at the same time. But in general, they were at least, I think the nearest ones were roughly 400 to 500 years before Jesus with Zechariah. Isaiah and the others were almost 700 or 800 years before Jesus. So, you know, why is it important, I think, to get an idea of these prophecies is to show that God had a plan, right? So he had this plan all along. It wasn't some random person that just showed up that kind of met these requirements. And as you'll see, kind of the requirements, they weren't, I wouldn't say super vague. Like a lot of times we think about prophecies of the future as sometimes being vague when we see people like, if I told you there's going to be another recession in the economy, I wouldn't be too surprised because it's probably going to happen based on past experience, right? But when we look at the prophecies about Jesus, I would say they're specific. Yeah, let's go from there. So the first prophecy is going to be, if you want to follow along in your Bible, they would have been up on the slides, but you may have to open your Bible this morning if you want. So Isaiah chapter 7. So again, Isaiah was a prophet to Judah. This was roughly somewhere 740 to 680 before Christ. So this was a fair amount of time before Jesus' birth. Okay, so Isaiah chapter 7, starting in verse 10, we're going to read down through verse 14. Let's see. Again, the Lord spoke to Ahaz, "Ask a sign of the Lord your God. Let it be deep as Sheol or high as heaven." But Ahaz said, "I will not ask, and I will not put the Lord to the test." And he said, "Hear then, O house of David, it is too little for you to weary men that you weary my God also. Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and she shall call his name Emmanuel." Okay, so we're talking fairly specific, right? Like we're saying there's going to be a virgin that shall conceive a son. Pretty specific, don't you think? It's also pretty, like, not conceivable to, like, the way we think life works, right? So Isaiah, roughly 700 years before Jesus. So remember this. "Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel." So like I said when I started, I'm looking at messianic prophecies that are distinctly fulfilled in the New Testament. So let's go to Matthew chapter 1. Verses 20 through 23. So I'm starting in the middle of verse 20. It says, "Behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a dream, saying, 'Joseph, son of David, do not fear to take Mary as your wife, for that which is conceived in her is from the Holy Spirit. She will bear a son, and you shall call his name Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins.' And behold, this took place to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet. 'Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel.'" Okay, so I think we know the rest of the story. Jesus was born. Okay, so he's born of a virgin in fulfillment of this prophecy. Okay. So the next prophecy I want to look at is about where he was born. So if we go to Micah, Micah chapter 5. It sometimes there's the books we don't spend a lot of time in, so it takes me a while to figure out where they are in the Bible. So Micah, again, he was a contemporary of Isaiah. So he was roughly 740 to 700 BC, also a prophet to Judah. So starting Micah chapter 5, verses 1 and 2, it says, "Now muster your troops, O daughter of troops. Siege is laid against us. With a rod they strike the judge of Israel on the cheek. But you, O Bethlehem, Ephrathah, hard to pronounce, who are too little to be among the clans of Judah, from you shall come forth for me one who is to be ruler in Israel, whose coming is from of old, from ancient days." Okay, so not only do we know how Jesus was going to be conceived, this is very specifically saying where this Messiah is coming from. So if we look at Matthew chapter 2, verses 2 through 6, we see the fulfillment of this. Matthew chapter 2, starting, we're going to read verses 2 through 6. So this was the wise men. Actually, I'll just start in verse 1. "So now after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, saying, 'Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him.' When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. And assembling all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. They told him, 'In Bethlehem of Judea, for so it is written by the prophet, And you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel.'" Okay, so we see this prophecy specifically where he's going to be born. This is not some big city. This wouldn't be like predicting someone's going to be born in Los Angeles or Paris or London. This is some little teeny, teeny city. We read in Micah, it's not even really on the rolls of the cities. So this is, again, another very, very specific prediction or prophecy. Okay, so we've seen how he's going to be conceived, where he's going to be conceived. Now, where is he going to live? Okay. So we often think, well, you're just going to live where you were born. Well, he had already taken this trip to a place for the census in Bethlehem. So he was, when people think of Jesus, where did Jesus live? He lived in Nazareth, right? Okay. So most people grow up where they were born. Jesus had a little bit of a unique route, though, right? So let's go to Hosea chapter 11, verse 1. Okay, Hosea chapter 11, verse 1. So we think of Jesus growing up in Nazareth, typically. He was born in Bethlehem. It says, "When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called him." I called my son, I'm sorry. Okay, so if you remember the story of Jesus, which we'll read in Matthew 2 also in verse 13 through 15, he took a little detour at the beginning of his life. Okay, so this was right after we read where Herod was trying to figure out where Jesus was born, right? So he'd asked the wise men, "Where's this guy? We saw the star." So let's go down to verse 13. So this was when the wise men, they didn't go back and tell Herod where it was, where Jesus was. So starting in verse 13 of Matthew chapter 2, it says, "Now when they had departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, 'Rise, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him.' And he rose and took the child and his mother by night and departed to Egypt and remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet, out of Egypt I called my son. So time after time we see at the beginning of Jesus' life, we see very specific prophecies, right? Where, how's he going to be conceived? Where is he going to be born? And then basically what happened in his early life. I'm not the person to go figure out the numerical odds of these things happening, but the odds of this being fulfilled by any one person, highly, highly unlikely, right? So that's kind of the beginning of his life. Like I said, I'm focusing on prophecies that are really just called out, both in the Old Testament and the New Testament. So as we get towards the end of his life, and so Jesus has done most of his work. We see where, you know, he knows what's going to be happening. He knows he's about to be crucified. But there's a lot of prophecies also about how all of that takes place, too. Okay, so if we go to Zechariah chapter 13. So Zechariah chapter 13 and verse 7. We see how you would think if Jesus truly was the Messiah that the people of the Old Testament were looking for, they were looking for this physical king, right? They were looking for this person who was going to come back and bring back the Israel of old with David and Saul and this great nation. So there's prophecy, so let's look at Zechariah chapter 13, verse 7. It says, "Awake, O sword, against my shepherd, against the man who stands next to me, declares the Lord of hosts. Strike the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered. I will turn my hand against the little ones." This one, when you first look at it, is like, how does this actually refer to Jesus, right? But when you think back of what happens, the disciples, as he gets to the end of his life, what do they do? They see Jesus is about to be crucified. Judas has taken the 30 pieces of silver to turn. Judas took the 30 pieces of silver to turn over Jesus to the authorities. And at first, you know, the disciples are fighting, right? Like Peter cuts off the soldier's ear. But then what happens? We're going to go down. So this was just the whole betrayal and arrest of Jesus. Let's see. I'm going to start in verse 52 of Matthew 26. It says, "Then Jesus said to him, 'Put your sword back into its place, for all who take the sword will perish by the sword. Do you think that I cannot appeal to my Father, and he will at once send me more than 12 legions of angels? But how then should the scriptures be fulfilled that it must be so? At that hour, Jesus said to the crowds, 'Have you come out as against a robber with swords and clubs to capture me? Day after day, I sat in the temple teaching, and you did not seize me. But all this has taken place that the scriptures of the prophets might be fulfilled.' Then all the disciples left him and fled." So we see that as Jesus is being struck down, what happens with his disciples? They all fled. They're starting to think that this physical kingdom's not going to take place. But that's not what God wanted, right? God prophesied way back with Zechariah that the disciples were going to forsake this future Messiah. Okay. So the next prophecy I want to look at is in Isaiah. So we often look at Isaiah 53 for how Jesus was during his accusations and towards his crucifixion. So Isaiah chapter 53, verse 7. The Bible reads, "He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth, like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, and like a sheep that before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth." So when you look at this, at first, we've been talking again in the high school classes on my mind because we just talked about this, but Paul, he was in front of the authorities, and what did Paul do? So when he was in front of Felix, he gave all of his, you know, why he believed in Jesus, and even got Felix to the point where Felix, he basically avoided what he needed to do, right? So I don't know, if I was on trial, I doubt I would be standing there silent. If I had a lawyer, I hope my lawyer's not silent, right? You hope there's someone speaking on your behalf, right? So this is kind of an interesting prophecy to me, right? Like, this person is oppressed, he's afflicted, and for some reason he's just taking it, right? Like, but why is he taking it? Number one, I would say it's part of God's plan. There is nothing more that needed to be said. But let's look at the fulfillment. So Matthew chapter 27, verses 11 through 14. Matthew 27, 11 through 14. Now Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus said, "You have said so." But when he was accused by the chief priests and elders, he gave no answer. Then Pilate said to him, "Do you not hear how many things they testify against you?" But he gave him no answer, not even to a single charge, so that the governor was greatly amazed. So again, we see the fulfillment of this prophecy, that the way Jesus would act, right? So this is not, a lot of times these prophecies are, it's probably not the way I would act. I don't know about you, but if I was, like I said, if I was in front of a judge, I would be trying to defend myself, because Jesus knew what was coming. I don't know if everybody else knew what was coming, but he knew what was coming. So if we continue for another prophecy, if we continue in Isaiah 53 further in verse 12, so this is about how Jesus was going to die. It says, "Therefore I will divide him a portion with the many, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he poured out his soul to death and was numbered with the transgressors. Yet he bore the sin of many and makes intercession for the transgressors." It's one of the interesting things when we read the Bibles. There's a lot of words in here that we don't use on a regular basis. Probably if I ask my kids what the word transgressor meant, I'm guessing... Do you know what the word transgressor means? Yes? No? No. Basically, a transgressor is someone who transgressed or broke the law, right? So, in the middle of the verse, it says he was numbered with the transgressors. But in the end, it says he makes intercession for the transgressors. So he was numbered with the transgressors. We'll see how he was crucified. But he was making intercession for the transgressors, which I would say is both you and me. That's all of us. Okay, so let's look at Mark chapter 15, verse 27. So this is when they talk about his crucifixion. So they had divided his lots, they cast lots for them, and they crucified him. Verse 27, it says, "And with him they crucified two robbers, one on his right and one on his left." So he was crucified with the transgressors. So he was specifically crucified with two robbers, right? But he was also crucified for our transgressions too. So not only do we read how... went in front of the governor being quiet. We read about how he was crucified, but let's read about how he was going to be buried. So just think about how these things, how this would happen and how unlikely these things would be, even if you kind of wrote a story to do this. So Isaiah chapter 53, verse 9 reads, "And they made his grave with the wicked and with a rich man in his death, although he had done no violence and there was no deceit in his mouth." So did Jesus have a tomb all picked out? Did his friends all know a place he was going to go? They weren't even expecting him to die, I don't think, right? They thought this guy was the Messiah, so You're probably not planning to get a burial plot for your Messiah. I mean, maybe unless you're like one of the Egyptian leaders where they're building their pyramids for hundreds of years. But that's not what Jesus was. So it says, and with a rich man in his death. So Jesus wasn't about earthly riches, wasn't worried about, you know, necessarily where he was going to be buried, other than we see this prophecy of where he was going to be buried. So let's read in Matthew 27. Matthew 27, verses 57 through 60. So again, this was after Jesus had died. So starting in verse 57, the Bible reads, "When it was evening, there came a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph, who also was a disciple of Jesus. He went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. Then Pilate ordered it to be given to him, and Joseph took the body and wrapped it in a clean linen shroud and laid it in his own new tomb, which he had cut in the rock. And he rolled a great stone to the entrance of the tomb and went away." So again, we see prophecy fulfilled in the way Jesus was buried. You know, if you were making up a story about how some great person's life, I don't even know that this would be the detail you would go to, right? The specificity and the detail that God gave in the prophecies, again, you know, this is 500 to 800 years before Jesus was born. So the specificity of the details of how he would be born or born and die are astounding. So there's the number of prophecies I went through this morning is not really probably scratching the surface of all the prophecy that's in the Bible. But what I wanted to do is just show or look at this, the examples we can clearly see spoken of in the Old Testament and then the fulfillment of them in the New Testament. There's all sorts of prophecies Jesus did about his own life, right? How he would die, how he would be raised on the third day, right? But if we look at the life and the plan that God sent out ahead of time, right? So we started out with he was born miraculously of a virgin. Where was he born? He was born in Bethlehem, little small city. Where did he live? Well, eventually he lived in Nazareth, but for a short period of time he lived in Egypt, right? Fulfilling prophecy. We see as he got to the end of the life, all of his friends left him. He was all by himself. How was he in front of the governor? He was silent. These were things God had prophesied long beforehand. How did he die? He was crucified, not by himself, but with other sinners, criminals, robbers. But he was also crucified for all of our transgressions. Lastly, how was he buried? So he was buried in a rich man's tomb, not necessarily the burial you might expect, but that's what God prophesied. And yet again, it was fulfillment of God's prophecy, even in his death. So back to what I started with Bill's sermons, I was really inspired, like the whole idea of the apologetics, right? Like how can we go out and how can we defend or, you know, just have a normal conversation with people about why do we believe the Bible? You know, why do I believe God is who he is? Why do I believe Jesus is who he is? You know, there's no one else out there that has prophecy like them, like Jesus did. You know, 800 years before his life, this is where he's going to be born. This is how where he's going to live. If that doesn't tell you that this guy was special, I don't know what would, right? This evidence is astounding of Jesus is somebody special, right? He wasn't just some guy with 1,000 followers at a megachurch, right? This guy was part of God's plan from the beginning. So back with Bill's apologetics lessons, it's just the whole idea that we can be willing and capable of speaking with people of why we believe what we believe, I think is super important, right? So don't ever be afraid. The Bible has got all sorts of examples of prophecy. I think on some level we have to be willing to work with people that let them understand what prophecy is, you know, foretelling the future, and then how it lines up. But this is important because people need to understand that the Bible is from God, right? And prophecy is one of the ways to show that there is one and true living God and why I should believe the Bible, right? But it's also why we should believe in Jesus. So, like I said, this isn't an exhaustive list of messianic prophecies. This is just an example of prophecies that are very clearly called out in the Old Testament and New Testament that I think can help help give us strength in believing what's in the Bible. So if you have any questions and you want to study, let's do it. Let's look down at the Bible. As I say in the high school class, you know, reading the Bible, that's where we need to go for our answers. It's not what I think, not what you think. Let's just get together and read the Bible and come to the answers, right? And the answers are in here. So if you have any questions, if you need any prayers, if you need any help, let's get together. With that, let's end my sermon. We'll sing the closing song.